We're in 1 Kings chapter 14, and now we're at a point where we're also going to be looking back at the book of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapters 11 and 12 are going to cover the reign of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah. We have not been looking at material in the book of 2 Chronicles really for a while now, since we were in chapter 10 of 1 Kings. So we've been on our own in 1 Kings for quite a while now, because the events that are described in chapters 11, 12, and 13 don't have any corresponding accounts in 2 Chronicles or anywhere else. That's some standalone material. It's only found in those chapters in 1 Kings. 1 Kings 11, just to remind ourselves, was about what happened to Solomon after he had become older and his married all of those women that were not Israelites, that were not servants of the Lord, and they turned his heart away from God to worshiping idols. And so God punished him, and Israel joined with him in that. And so Solomon himself was punished, and so was Israel for that. God raised up enemies for Solomon. There were a couple of them that were of other nations outside of him that caused him trouble at that point. And then also one on the inside, a fellow Israelite, one that he had appointed over the most populous tribe in Israel, of course, dual tribe, that of the house of Joseph. So that included the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. But that man was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. He was appointed as he was a young man that was very able, and Solomon appointed him as the leader of that house. That was the most populous tribe together in all of Israel, only to or rivaling that of Judah, which, of course, that was Solomon's own tribe. So Jeroboam thereby was really the most powerful man in Israel next to Solomon. God obviously had put him in that position. That was God's work to raise Jeroboam up then to be a rival to Solomon as part of his punishment. And so God had determined he was going to split the kingdom, and he was going to give 10 tribes to Jeroboam to rule over and leave only Judah and Benjamin under Solomon's descendants for David's sake. That's what we were studying about in 1 Kings chapter 11. And then that happens after Solomon's death at the end of that chapter. And then chapter 12 describes for us the events where the kingdom was divided. There's a little bit of that, of course, in 2 Chronicles that we saw. But then 1 Kings 12 goes on to tell us about all the specific things that Jeroboam did. And that's why we were only in 1 Kings. The book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings primarily focus on those kings of Israel, the northern kingdom, until we get to chapter 17 of 2 Kings. And then that's the end of that kingdom. And then it's only Judah is left. But up to that point, 1 Kings and 2 Kings mostly focus on those kings of the northern kingdom, where 2 Chronicles is mostly focusing on the kings of Judah. So that's why we'll see a heavier weight for one versus the other in that regard. Also why we have a lot more detail about Jeroboam in 1 Kings than in 2 Chronicles, which is why we didn't have that anything to look at on some of these things in 2 Chronicles about Jeroboam. So then chapter 13 of 1 Kings told us about God, the prophet that the Lord sent to rebuke Jeroboam and to prophesy against the altar that he had made. And then he didn't repent of that. It also told us what happened to that prophet. And then chapter 14 started with Jeroboam, his son becoming sick, and he sends his wife to Ahijah the prophet, that one that first appeared to him back in chapter 11 to tell him that he was going to become king. And then he prophesied that that child of theirs would die because he was good. And so God was going to spare him from all the destruction and evil that he was going to bring upon the rest of the house of Jeroboam because of its wickedness. And then he also prophesied ultimately of the destruction of that entire kingdom because of all those sins that were being committed that were going to persist there. And all of that, of course, did come to pass exactly as the Lord said. So then we get to 1 Kings chapter 14, where we are now, to verse 21, where now the attention is turned to Rehoboam, Solomon's son, who is now king of Judah. The only thing we've read about him so far was what happened after Solomon died at the end of chapter 11, where Rehoboam then becomes king of Israel. But at that time, the tribes of Israel agreed to follow him only if he would agree to make their burdens lighter. And then he listened to the advice of his younger men, his younger advisors over the older, wiser men that had served under his father Solomon. The older ones had counseled him to speak kindly to the people and to agree to make their burdens lighter, and then they would follow him. Instead, he listened to the younger men who advised him to tell them that he was going to make their, my father chastised you with whips, I'll chastise you with scorpions. He listened to that and gave them that, that answer 3 days after, according to the agreed upon time. And so then all the 10 tribes then said, to your tents, O Israel. And then they anointed, made Jeroboam their king. So what did Rehoboam do next? Well, he sent a tax collector to try to assert his authority to show that he was, in spite of their refusal to follow him, he was going to make sure that they paid their money. What did they do with his tax collector? They killed him. So then what was Rehoboam's next move? Well, he gathered an army together. He was going to go. There was going to be a civil war in Israel over this. But it was averted because God sent a prophet to Rehoboam and told him, this is from me. Don't go and fight with your brethren. Did Rehoboam listen to the Lord's prophet then? He did. So he stood down and there was no war fought. And so then he was king over Judah, and Benjamin followed him, but the other 10 tribes followed Jeroboam. So that's all we've read about Rehoboam up to this point. Now we're going to read about what happened to him and in his kingdom during his time of reign over the kingdom of Judah. We'll go ahead and read from 1 Kings to establish this. Far more detail coming in 2 Chronicles, as we mentioned, but we'll look at the summary of his reign as it's recorded here in 1 Kings 14. But just to get all of this together, let's go ahead and read 21 to 31, we'll get Brother Stephen to read this. This will be good because 2 Chronicles has a ton of these difficult Hebrew names. So by doing the 1 Kings first and letting Stephen read that, he's going to be spared for once from having to read that list of those difficult Hebrew names. But Brother Stephen, if you would read 21 to 31 here in 1 Kings 14.
Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord did choose out of all the tribes of Israel. Put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah, and Ammonitess. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sin which they had committed, for all that their father had done. For they also built them high places, and images, and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. And there were also Solomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nation which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. And it came to pass in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. And he took away the treasure of the house of the Lord and the treasure of the king's house. He even took away all, and he took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made. And King Rehoboam made in his stead brazen shield and committed them unto the hands of the chief of the guard, which kept the door of the king's house. And it was so, when the king went into the house of the Lord, that the guard bare him and brought him back into the guard's chambers. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the king of Judah? And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all that day. And Rehoboam slept with his fathers, and he buried him, his fathers, in the city of David. And his mother's name was Naamah, and Ammonitess, and Abijam, his son, reigned in his stead.
Okay, so there's the summary of Rehoboam's reign. So he reigned in Judah, as it says in verse 21. How old was he when he became king? He was 41. How many years did Solomon reign over Israel? 40. So that tells us that Rehoboam was born the year before Solomon became king over Israel. All his life, he'd only known his father as king of Israel. So that was his entire existence up to this point. Seeing his father with that reign, with all of his power, also, of course, he would have been around during that time. He was a grown man. And seeing all the events that happened later in Solomon's life when he was worshiping idols and those things, have an influence on Rehoboam? It did, we're going to see what happens to him. We already get the bottom line of that in verse 22 in 1 Kings 14 with what happened to Judah under his reign. He was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned for 17 years, in Jerusalem. He says, the city which the Lord did choose out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. Now who was Rehoboam's mother? See, he was a product of the problem that Solomon had that caused him to turn away from the Lord. So not only was Rehoboam around and grew up and ultimately got to see with his own eyes what his father was doing, but who was his mother? His mother was an Ammonite. Who were the Ammonites? So we never can get away from any of this, can we? Whatever is practically whatever chapter we read, we're going to see things mentioned. But to fully understand and appreciate what's going on, what he's telling us, we're going to have to refresh ourselves on the roots of all of that. And then how often do we find it goes back to Genesis? over and over again we see that. Well, here's another case. He mentions the mother's name, Rehoboam's mother's name there, but also where she was from. But that's very significant. Well, who were the Ammonites? If we're going to understand who Rehoboam's mother was and how this plays into the events of his life and his reign over Judah, what happens to that kingdom, these are extremely important things, but we need to understand about his mother and who the Ammonites were. Well, that goes back to who was Ammon, the original Ammon, for whom the nation was named. A son of Lot by one of his daughters, his two daughters that survived came out of Sodom and Gomorrah with him, and then they made their father drunk, and they both became pregnant by him, and one was the became the mother of Ammon, the other the mother of Moab. So those were two nations that descended from Lot, Moab and Ammon. Well, the mothers of those nations were not righteous by their conduct, but what happened to those descendants of Lot, those two nations? So this, of course, Lot was Abraham's nephew. So, I mean, here the nation of Israel, they are the descendants of Abraham himself. Ammon and Moab are the descendants of his nephew Lot, just like Edom was the descendants. They were the descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob. So those three nations, Edom, Ammon, and Moab, were related, closely related to Israel. And it's sad what happened, that those three nations were born from those ultimately that loved the Lord and served the Lord. But here are nations of their descendants that were wicked, those three nations. And eventually they were destroyed, going to much later into the Bible and the history of the Old Testament. Their destruction was prophesied of the Lord by the Lord through Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and Nebuchadnezzar did destroy them because of all their wickedness. But when Israel came up out of Egypt, out of their bondage there to the land of Canaan, they passed through the territory of those nations, and God had forbidden them to destroy those nations and to take their territory, because God had provided that their lands as an inheritance because of who they were. So that was, those were neighbors of Israel that they were forbidden to destroy. The other nations of the Canaanite nations, they were commanded to destroy and take their land. So there was a difference between those Amorite people and the Ammonite and Moabite and Edomite people. Yes?
I think, you know, you just were speaking about how the Moabites and Ammonites, people are now people, descendants of godly people. You know, some obviously some circumstances there that were not
something went wrong.
But it reminds me of Hosea, and it's very popular. Remember the part that said, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." That part, as it continues, and it's scary to us, and a reminder there to do the best we can as parents to raise our children in as good and godly a way as we know how. In humility, accepting what we're wrong, continually trying to grab on to what we're not doing, grab on to His commandments. So what it says in Hosea 4, verse 6, says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God, I will also forget thy children." And it's not God being vindictive or mean, but it's a natural consequence. If I'm not practicing His commandment in my house, there's a high chance of my children, just by the natural consequence of things, if I'm explaining His word away, there's a good chance that they're going to be doing, they're going to be raised doing the same thing. And there's a good chance that they'll be forgotten, in a sense that it's not that they can't turn to God, but the natural consequences is that ungodliness begets ungodliness.
Well, that's exactly right, and there's a related portion of this. God's people, of course, that's in Hosea, speaking about Israel directly, what happened, it happened to them, but it is the same thing that happened to those others. So you have the, I mean, we can look at nations descended from the godliest of people, from Abraham and his nephew, and from his grandchildren, Esau and Jacob himself, who became Israel. What happened to the Israelites? But there's a common root to all of that. Even though you can see the there is a righteous beginning, well, where did things go wrong? Because it surely did. But yes, destroyed for lack of knowledge. I mean, people that know the Lord and know His commandments, is that going to serve as a spiritual protection to them? I mean, absolutely. What else will? And then the other aspect of that, it's kind of the other side of that same coin, but also in the book of Hosea in chapter 7, he says in verse 8, what was the problem here, speaking of Ephraim, which is the, just like Judah became the term because of it was being the dominant tribe of the southern kingdom, Ephraim was the dominant tribe of the northern kingdom, and so we'll see it referred to as Israel very often, but also very often as Ephraim. But this is speaking of that northern kingdom of Israel. It says, Ephraim, he hath mixed himself among the people. So that lack of knowledge that destroyed them in chapter 4, verse 6, and then here in chapter 7, mixed themselves among the people. Well, becoming, forgetting God and His Word, His teachings, His commandments, and then becoming involved in, mixed into the world. Do those two things tend to go together? I mean, forgetting God, being part of the world and forgetting God, that goes together. In fact, when Israel came out of Egypt, we know what happened to that first generation that wandered in the wilderness. They turned away from the Lord, and God would not permit them to enter the land of Canaan. But the next generation, their children, the very ones that back in Numbers chapter 14, they said, when the spies went into Canaan and they returned, and Joshua and Caleb gave a good report, this is the land that flows with milk and honey, like the Lord said, He's promised to give us that land, let's go and take it. But the other 10 spies spoke of the number of people, and there were giants and their cities and walls and all those things, and discouraged the hearts of the people, where they said, you brought us out here to make our children a prey. And God said, you're not going to enter in, but those children you say that I brought out here to be a prey, they're the ones that are going to go and enter in. And they did, under Joshua as their leader. That generation served the Lord, and served the Lord all the days of Joshua and the elders of the people that they became. That generation was a righteous one. Let's turn to Judges chapter 2 for a moment. It's good to refresh ourselves on all of this because it does directly pertain to these events that are now happening in Israel and Judah during the time that we're looking at here in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles. But in Judges chapter 2, let's read verse 7 first of all and see this statement. This is the good part. Judges 2 verse 7, what was happening in Israel at this time with that first generation that entered Canaan. It says, and the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that He did for Israel. So these are that first generation that entered Canaan, which would be the second generation of Israel as it was born as a nation out of its bondage. The first one, their fathers were wicked and they all died out. But these people grew up seeing all of the Lord's works that He had done. They were there eating of that manna, seeing the miracles almost every day from that, with the Lord providing for them all of those years, everything else that God had done, all that He had done in giving them the land of Canaan. And they were there to see all that and knew it firsthand. So they saw it with their eyes and they had faith and they obeyed the Lord. What happened to their children? Well, something very sad happened to their children. They forsook the Lord. And He tells us exactly why they forsook the Lord and what happened to them. Let's read verses 10 through 14, Brother Dave, from Judges chapter 2, 10 through 14.
And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which He had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and served Baal. And the And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods, but the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked the Lord to anger. And they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Asherah. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers that spoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies round about, so that they could not any longer stand before their enemies.
Okay, so Lot was a righteous man, wasn't he? We're told about his righteousness in the book of Genesis. He's upheld as an example of righteousness in Hebrews chapter 11, part of that great cloud of witnesses, and 2 Peter chapter 2, and how his righteous soul was vexed from day to day seeing the ungodly deeds in Sodom and Gomorrah. But that righteous man lost his children. Why? Isaac was a righteous man. He lost Esau, and then Esau's children followed wickedness. What happened? Well, Israel, here's a generation that was lost. Here was a generation that was righteous before them that served the Lord. Then they lost their children. How did this generation that grew up in the wilderness, seeing all that they did, knowing who the Lord was, serving Him faithfully all of their days, receiving all of the Lord's blessings that they did in Canaan, and then they lost their children? What happened? Well, what did we see in Hosea? It's what happened here. He tells us the reasons why they lost their children. What happened in verse 10 was the first thing that he points out. And how does it compare to Hosea 4, verse 6? My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Well, what happened in verse 10 here in Judges 2? Who knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Does it sound like they were destroyed by lack of knowledge? Ignorance. They were destroyed by lack of knowledge. Well, but who didn't teach them? So was there a failure to teach, to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? There obviously was a failure with this generation to teach their children what they should know. Does that absolve the children from seeking the Lord to learn, even if those that had not taught them like they should didn't? I mean, no one has the excuse of blaming their ignorance on other people. Now, if we know what we know and understand what we do of the Lord, it's our responsibility to bring up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Who's going to answer the Lord for whether or not we have done that? That will be what we answer for, but we have a lot of scriptures that let us know that nobody has an excuse to not seek God. We all know that we have a Maker. We should seek Him. However, Edward was pointing out, there is a natural consequence to these things. When we don't teach the children and they're ignorant, is it likely that they're going to turn to the world and mix with the people of the world? What happened here? They were ignorant. They didn't know God. And then they did evil in the sight of the Lord. And they forsook the Lord for these idols of these nations that were around them. And chapter 3 is going to begin by talking about the thorns in their sides as they married the children of those nations around them that they were told not to. So did they mix themselves with the people? They became part of the world, and they didn't know God and didn't know His word. So they were destroyed for lack of knowledge and for being mixed with the people, being a part of the world. Of the world, not just in the world. Well, we're all to be in it, but we're not to be of it. They became of it and forgot the Lord. So, those are two of the biggest things. We see it right here in Judges. We see it in Hosea. We see the fruits of it in all these examples that we're considering. Also now in what happens with with Solomon's own child. Here was Solomon, and of course Solomon repented at the end, but how much damage was done to his family as a result of his sins, and how did those consequences bear out? Well, even though he repented, here his son is Rehoboam, who was a child of an Ammonitess. Well, should Solomon have had a wife that was from Ammon in the first place? Well, those Ammonites were wicked. They weren't serving the Lord. Back in 1 Kings chapter 11, when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. It tells us in 1 Kings 11 and verse 4, just to refresh. And it says in verse 5 that Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So it specifically mentions Ammon, and that Solomon went after his wives, turned his heart. So then it specifically mentions the Ammonites. Well, I mean, he had 1,000 women. He may have had more than one Ammonitess for a wife. We know he had at least one, though, and we know her name, don't we? From 1 Kings chapter 14 there, who was the mother of Rehoboam. So Rehoboam's mother was an Ammonitess named Naamah. Was she part of that? Was she among those who turned? Did she help turn Solomon's heart to that abomination of the Ammonites? Yes. Did Solomon convert her to follow Jehovah, or did she turn him to follow her idol? I mean, what happens when children of God marry people of the world? Well, what happened in Genesis 6 when the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they married them? What happened within a generation? You've got Noah and his family, you've got 8 righteous people left on earth, and the rest of them are wicked, where every imagination of their heart was only evil continually. How did that happen? Because the sons of God, God's people, married people of the world. So that same thing, mixing in, becoming part of the world, forgetting God and His Word, that's happened. That pattern has happened over and over again. And we don't learn that lesson at our own peril and for that of our children and their children and so forth. That happened to Solomon. So he married these women. He had children by them. Well, one of them now becomes king, his successor his throne. And he had his father's example in following these idols. His mother was a worshiper of idols, obviously, from what we're told in chapter 11. So Rehoboam, how much wickedness had he learned growing up? Now, having grown up in Israel and then his father having repented, did he have any teaching? Don't follow these idols. When we have the book of Ecclesiastes that's left for us, that testimony from Solomon of what he had learned and all of that, did he tell that to his own son Rehoboam? No doubt. Did Rehoboam consider that? Well, we're going to see a bit more in 2 Chronicles that he did learn some things. Well, we already know that he at least listened to the Lord's prophet that said, don't go fight and have this big war to try to keep the kingdom from being divided. But here he is, a child of an Ammonitess, and obviously had a lot of problems in his upbringing as far as what he had been taught and what he had had for an example. And it left a mark on him that wasn't going to go away. So in verse 22 in 1 Kings 14, what did Judah do during his time? Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins, which they had committed above all that their fathers had done. So things are, we know what was going on in Israel in the northern kingdom under Jeroboam. Now here's what happens during Rehoboam's reign in the southern kingdom. How sad is this? I mean, David, those 40 years he reigned, a man after God's own heart, and the people followed him during his days, and then Solomon. And so we'd had those 80 years where until Solomon was old and he turned away from the Lord, and then the people start following him in the idol worshiping. But up until that point, we had those several decades, that high point in Israel's history, when their leaders and the people themselves are following the Lord. Just like we saw with Joshua in that generation. But as was the case then, with that generation that followed Joshua, and we saw why, what happens with the children, Solomon's own child and the children of those others that had been there and had the opportunity to see all of the Lord's blessings for when they were following him, but then what happened with their children? They lost their children. So this is so sad to read about, and not just individuals or a few families, which is bad enough, but here's the entire generation of the nation. They did evil in the sight of the Lord and provoked God to jealousy with their sins. They had become worse than their fathers. What did they do? They built high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. Where did they learn that? Well, Solomon brought it in because of the wives that he brought in there. So Solomon, and we noted this because in chapter 11, when God said he was going to make Jeroboam king over 10 tribes and take them away from Solomon, he specifically mentioned that it was punishment also for Israel who were doing those things. So when Solomon, when the king turned, did the people go with him? They did. The people followed him in it. And so they're also worshiping these idols as he did. And when Solomon repented, was he able to undo all the damage that he had done to his family and the kingdom during that time? And we'll see another example of that later, Lord willing, with Manasseh, who was Hezekiah's son. And he followed wickedness and caused the people to. And then he eventually repented and tried to undo his own damage and couldn't. But again, consequences of sins and foolish decisions. We do those things. Are we likely to be able to undo all the problems that go along with it? And we need to be very careful in every action that we take that it's pleasing to God. Not just for our own sake, but how that can have so many effects on so many others, even our own children and beyond, and the ripple effect for that that can go for generations, and of course, ultimately, into eternity. So that we see as part of Solomon's legacy. It's sad, but it's true. And what else? What else was a mark of the wickedness of that generation? Verse 24 of 1 Kings 14. And this ought to get our attention for as we look at what's going on in our own world today. And there were also Sodomites in the land. And they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. What was the reason? God gave two reasons why he gave Canaan to the people of Israel. And he also told them at the time why he didn't. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 9 and read verses 4 through 6, what Moses spoke to the people of Israel. Deuteronomy 9, verses 4 through 6. Brother Glenn.
Speak not thou in thy heart after that the Lord thy God hath cast him out from before thee, saying, for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord hath driven him out from before thee. Not for thy righteousness, understand that.
All right, so, of course, we know what happened to that generation that didn't get to enter Canaan. We saw, did their children learn to do righteously? Yes, we were reading about that, but we also lost how they read about how they lost their own children. But God made it clear when he said he was going to give them the land of Canaan, was he rewarding them, say, here, because you're so righteous, that's why I'm giving you Canaan. No, he gave the two reasons. And what were the two reasons? Well, he was being faithful to Abraham and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to their fathers, the covenant that he had made with them and promised them that land. So he had sworn to their fathers that he was going to do that. So God was keeping his word. He was keeping his promise that he had made to them. He said he was going to give that land to their descendants, and he was going to do it, and he did. So that was number one, to keep his own word. But what was the other reason? Because of the wickedness of those people in the land. He was going to root them out and destroy them. Now back in Genesis chapter 15, here's the father. He mentioned Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob there in Deuteronomy 9. Well, when it was in Abraham's time, when God told Abraham what he was going to do and give them that land, he told them, he told Abraham, Abram as he was known at the time, what was going to happen to those people, and there was going to be a delay in time before he fulfilled all of that, and there were reasons for that. But let's read Genesis 15, 12 through 16. Brother Edward, can you read that?
Genesis 15?
Yep, 12 through 16.
When the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not barren, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with a great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, and thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full.
So for 400 years they were going to be in bondage to a nation. He doesn't name them there. That nation is what? Egypt. God was going to judge Egypt, and they were going to come out of Egypt with great substance. Did he fulfill all of that? He did. Why was it going to be 400 years that they were going to have to sojourn in that land in bondage in Egypt? Well, he gives a reason there. He was going to give them that land, and as we saw in Deuteronomy 9, a major part of that was because of the wickedness of the people. But at the time here he was speaking to Abram, were they righteous then? No, but what does he say? He was going to give them that their land at what point in verse 16?
Iniquity was full.
Was it yet full? Not at this time. It was going to be. Alright, well, what sentence did he pronounce upon those nations because of their wickedness when it was full? Utter destruction. It can be hard for us to understand that when God makes a sentence that don't leave any alive to breathe. Men, women, children. I mean, it was the ultimate in sentences against those nations. Utter destruction. We can look at that and that can challenge our own understanding. Well, why would God command them to do that? Well, there's an answer there. And there's also a reason why he didn't do it before then. Did the punishment have to fit the crime? He wasn't going to give the full, utter destruction as the sentence, as his judgment, until their iniquity was full. The nations were completely wicked. Until that point, he wasn't going to bring upon them something that they were not yet worthy of. But did they become worthy of that sentence of judgment by God? They did. So God brought it to pass at the time when they were worthy of that judgment. So it took 400 years. Now, is there anybody other than God that would know the hearts of every individual person, of the nations as a whole, to be able to know exactly when that point was reached? We can't see things that God, we can certainly observe, and according to the teachings of God's word, we can identify what is right, what is wrong, what is good and evil, what is wickedness. But to be able to know when that point is reached, God has sight and wisdom, obviously, that we don't, never will. But when that happened, as he said in Deuteronomy 9, it was because of that wickedness that God said, okay, there, he was going to completely vacate them from the land. That was his sentence. Now, in Leviticus chapter 18, God gave a... And right now, we're not going to read all of... Leviticus 19 contains a list of graphic and horrible examples of immorality. The specific types of immorality that people engage in. And it's very explicit. And he told them exactly, don't do this, don't do this, thou shalt not do this. And goes through that whole list. Leviticus 19 contains so many of those commands. We're not going to read all of that right now. But verse 22, he says, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. Now that's a statement from God Almighty who made man, made male and female, and established the family in Genesis chapter 2, created by God himself. And God made clear who was to marry whom and why. Well, when man goes against that, and here he's describing homosexuality, and what is God's judgment of it? It is abomination. That's not my word. That's not your word. That is the word of God. And he told the people not to do any of those things. Let's read 24 through 30. I know we're running out of time. I'll go ahead and read that here quickly before we close. But in Leviticus 9, I said 19. This is chapter 18, rather. But he says, defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it. And the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew not you out also, when you defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. For whosoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the souls that commit them shall be cut off from among their people. Therefore shall ye keep mine ordinance, that ye commit not any one of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. Therein I am the Lord your God. I mean, what was Sodom and Gomorrah known for? What happened to them? And God is giving, told Abram, who was intentionally living in the plains and away from those cities where his son lived, that had repercussions that goes down to Solomon's time with the very wickedness of Ammon, the children of Lot, Ammon, and Moab. And God said, these are the things the people were doing in the land of Canaan. And when their wickedness became full, what's one of the marks of that complete wickedness? When they would go to that point, well, had the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah become full? He gave that same judgment, utter destruction. He destroyed them all. Well, what was one of the marks of when their wickedness became full? When they embraced those kind of abominable, immoral customs, as he put it there, and when they were doing those kinds of things, and when it became openly, openly practiced with no shame whatsoever, oh, you see that. And what does he mention happened in Israel? He says these people became worse than their fathers. As he says, they became like these nations around them. Well, it was one of the things he specifically mentions that was going on in the land at that time. They had those Sodomites in the land. So just like those people around them, now that comes. So the idols coming, turning away from God, being ignorant of God's commandments, and then becoming a part of the world. What's the world about? All this immorality. And he specifically mentions that. Well, we read things like this in God's word. We look and see what's going on in our own time. Does that give us pause? It should. Are we going to go along with, well, there's something wrong with you if you say there's something wrong with that? Well, this is what God says about it. And it's horrifying what's going on in our world today that we see about us, even in our own country, and what's been going on these in recent years. We have quite a challenge to shine as lights in this wicked and perverse nation. But that's our job. But we, while we're in it, in this world, we better not become a part of it. And we have such a challenge to teach our children and ground them in the Lord's ways that they're not ignorant of God's commandments and that they end up going into this wicked world and becoming like them, like what happened there.
Just going along with this, I think it's seeing the children of Israel being yoked to these unbelieving nations, and this the admonition for ourselves. I'm just very surprised sometimes seeing brothers or sisters willing to, they report someone outside of the assembly on occasion that's very concerning. It's not something we should apologize about being strong on that. Because it doesn't just, it's bad, it would be bad enough if it just affected them. But if you marry an unbeliever, you're in the church, it affects the church, it brings those kind of things into the church. And so I know for us, as strong as we know how, we cannot marry outside the faith at all. Not just, if you're outside the faith, you look for a good, faithful person inside the church. Because these things will affect you, they'll affect your children. We shouldn't apologize about it.
If we don't learn anything else from reading about what happened, why there was a Noah in the ark, what happened to Solomon, all these things that we're looking at right now, what's going on in Judah with the split in the kingdom, and now what's happening to Jeroboam and the impact on so many people for generations, if we don't learn that lesson from all that, what's it going to take? But we have so many things to look at there that are so practical for our time. That's why we're not to mix with them. I mean, how did they mix with the world? They married the people of those nations. But we have to keep ourselves separate from the wickedness of the world. We're in the world. We can't be of it.
The only other strong thing to that, which makes this a balance, we're not here to save each other. We're here to save the world. That was the command that we were given. Spread His word. So, yes, I get it on both sides, but that's where that becomes so difficult. And we have to, prayer has to be made at all. Every second.
Yeah.
Because that's where it sits.
1 Timothy 2 tells us to pray for all men. God is not willing that any should perish, but all come to the knowledge of the truth. And we're to be lights in the world. Part of that is, to be a light. We could physically remove ourselves from all the wickedness that's in this world, but that would not accomplish God's will, because then the world would have no light. That is our task. The world in its darkness needs to see that light. We're it.
Because I know in my own head, I'm not trying to contradict anything that was just said. I'm just saying that.
Well, it goes along with it. It goes along with it. We have to be the salt of the earth. We have to be the ones trying to influence this world with righteousness. That's part of our task. But the problem is where it goes the other way. And that's what happened to Solomon and so many of these others, is when we become a part of the world, then the world is, the influence is coming from the world upon us. And then instead of us converting the world to Christ, the world is converting us to it. Instead of being, we're becoming conformed to the world rather than being transformed by the renewing of our mind. Romans 12, 1 and 2. We've got both sides to deal with. We've got a responsibility to the world to be the salt of it, the light of it, but we cannot let ourselves get pulled into it. That's going to forever be our challenge.
And last thing, not the last thing, but that's what makes this so important.
Yeah.
That's what makes this time so important.
On that.